Next on RadioSt.Pete.com, Peter's Proffer with Clearwater attorney Peter Tragos. The experienced lawyers at Tragos, Sartes, and Tragos discuss common legal questions, providing insight into the legal process and covering current events as they relate to the legal field.
We're back at it here on Peter's Proffer in the courtroom of current events with a very special episode interviewing Larry Simpson, who was the prosecutor who tried and convicted Ted Bundy here in Florida all those years ago. He was recently portrayed by Jim Parsons, the guy from Big Bang Theory, in Netflix's newest movie with Zac Efron acting as Ted Bundy. So that's a fun fact. And we're going to get into the specifics of the trial, the specifics of the case, the craziness that surrounded it. It's going to be a really fun episode. So I know you guys are going to enjoy this one. Don't forget, this is the third part of our serial killer podcast series. We only have one more week of entries to win the Amazon gift card of $25 and the Tragos Artists and Tragos t-shirt. So like us on all social media and post a question or tag some friends on our Peter's Proffer page. And we will do a drawing at the end of the month to figure out who's going to win that. So buckle your seatbelts because this one's going to be fun. Here we go.
Okay. Larry, I'm glad you're with us. I think people already know that you were the lead prosecutor on the Ted Bundy case. They probably don't know you and I went to law school together, but that's not quite as important. We have some questions we like to throw at you. We've put you on Facebook. We've got some people that have responded on Facebook to some questions and information they'd like to know. We even got a response from a lawyer that you had a case with who responded to us that we know and said, gee, I didn't know Larry was the Ted Bundy prosecutor. I would have talked to him about that. But what was his name?
Brandon Ballou.
Ballou, right.
Yeah, so we are really excited about it. We've been doing a series on serial killers, some of the documentaries we've had. An FBI agent that was a special investigator that handled some serial killer cases. And then we also had an investigative reporter that did it for about 40 years following different serial killers throughout the media portion of these cases and investigations. So we're really excited to have somebody that was in a serial killer case everybody knows about. So to start out talking about it, how did you get picked to try the Ted Bundy case and to kind of go through it? Because you were a fairly young prosecutor at the time, weren't you?
Yes, I was only 29. I'd been out of law school just a little over 4 years. But the whole time I was out of law school, I had been an assistant state attorney. I'd handled major cases, homicides and things like that before this. But what actually happened is that Mr. Bundy was arrested in Pensacola, Florida. And at the time of his arrest, he was driving a stolen vehicle that had been stolen here in Tallahassee. He also had a lot of stolen property, stolen credit cards, stolen identifications, all that had come from Tallahassee. And initially, I was assigned to handle those cases. In other words, I was going to handle all of the
stolen
theft cases, credit card fraud cases, and so forth. And there was a different assistant state attorney who was assigned to handle the homicide investigation. Realized at that point in time, we did not know whether or not Mr. Bundy was even a suspect in our case. Nobody even knew he was in Tallahassee at the time of the murders. And quite frankly, if whenever Mr. Bundy decided that he was going to leave Tallahassee, if he had jumped on a Greyhound bus and left like that, we with no ties back to Tallahassee, we probably never would have solved these murders.
Wow.
But at any rate, what happened is after a month or so of that process going forward with the investigation of the homicide while I was handling the other cases, the prosecutor that was assigned to the homicide investigation resigned from our office. And at that point, the state attorney came to me and asked me if I would take over the cases. All of them, including the homicide case, and I agreed to do so.
Why do you think the state attorney didn't want to jump on him?
Well, you would have to ask the state attorney, because that decision was not I was not party to that decision. Okay.
Larry, was that Willie Meigs?
No, that was Harry Morrison was the state attorney at the time.
Was he trying cases as a state attorney?
No, not at that point in time. He wasn't. He, of course, had tried tons of cases earlier on. He was originally an assistant state attorney before he late in life he decided to run for state attorney and was elected. But he did not typically try cases. He did second chair a murder case with me that I had tried, I guess, about 6 months or so before all of this came down.
So what actually ended up connecting Ted Bundy to the murders in Tallahassee if he was picked up in Pensacola on kind of stolen property charges?
Well, we were able to hold him on the stolen property charges. And once I was assigned to the homicide investigation, what I did is I put together a task force of local law enforcement officers. I got two investigators from the sheriff's office, two investigators from the Tallahassee Police Department, and two investigators from the FSU Police Department who were assigned directly to me. And for about 6 weeks, we went about trying to determine whether or not Mr. Bundy could have committed the murders, investigated where he was living at the time, talked to witnesses that may have been in the area. And one of the things that we did back in those days, this was very unusual, and that is during the autopsy, the pathologist saw what he understood to be a bite mark on one of the victims. And he was not a forensic pathologist. He knew it had some significance, and he wasn't sure exactly what to do with it. So there was no swabbings that was taken from the bite mark. And he decided that we needed to preserve the bite mark. And so he actually cut it out and put it in a bottle of formaldehyde.
Wow.
Which at that point it began shrinking, and it was totally worthless for purposes of using it for comparison purposes later. What we did have, though, is out of the thousands of crime scene photographs and autopsy photographs that were taken in this case, there was one photograph of that bite mark that was taken with a ruler in place. Because there was a ruler in place, we were able to take that photograph and blow it up to a one-to-one. And if we had a model of Mr. Bundy's teeth, then we could go about making some sort of a comparison to determine whether or not Bundy could have left the bite mark on the victim. And so what we did is we went to a judge and applied for and had the judge issue a search warrant to search Mr. Bundy's mouth and obtain plaster casts of his teeth that we could then later use for comparison purposes. And that search warrant was executed on Bundy here in Tallahassee. He was taken to a local dentist's office. We had a forensic odontologist who specializes in things like bite marks come to Tallahassee and actually take the moldings from Mr. Bundy's teeth so that they could later be used for comparison purposes.
Larry, did he cooperate in giving you that cast, or did he fight it?
Well, he may have been going to fight it, but our forensic odontologist, Dr. Suveron, explained to Mr. Bundy that he had a tool that would make his mouth open and showed it to him, and Mr. Bundy decided at that point that he would cooperate.
Yeah, it wasn't worth the fight at that point. So how early in the investigative process did the media get involved? When did they get wind that you may have had a suspect that you picked up on some random charges, basically, that may be part of this big homicide?
Well, what happened is when Mr. Bundy was arrested in Pensacola, he gave an alias, and he said that his name was Ken Meisner. And so the next day in the Tallahassee Democrat, there was a huge headline in the paper that said FSU All-American track star Ken Meisner arrested in Pensacola.
Wow.
And, of course, Ken Meisner, who was here at the time, he called the Democrat and the Sheriff's Department and explained that no, he had not been arrested in Pensacola. And it was 3 days before we were able to determine that it was, in fact, Mr. Bundy that was under arrest in Pensacola. Once we knew who it was and began investigating his background, it was very obvious that he had to be a suspect in the murders that happened here, especially with the stolen car and stolen credit cards and so forth that tied him directly to this area.
So what was the media frenzy like at that point?
Well, it wasn't that great initially because really nobody knew who he was. But once it was determined who he was, then of course the media got involved in the situation. And from that point forward, in any and every court proceeding, there was a ton of media presence.
And one of those, at least that's portrayed in most of the documentaries or movies or things that I've seen on it, has a, sometimes it looks like the courthouse, but you told me it was actually at the jail where the indictment was read aloud to Ted Bundy with all the media around, and seemed like a big publicity stunt kind of thing by the sheriff. Did that kind of get it rolling even more than it was before?
Well, certainly. Once we had the indictment, then everything really escalated from there, because that's whenever we started having a lot of court proceedings and various things going on in the case. Up until that point, of course, our investigation was confidential, and so we weren't holding press conferences or doing anything else like that that would draw attention to the case.
Larry, how much time elapsed from the murders until the indictment?
It was, I want to say, roughly 4 to 4.5 months. It took a while. I mean, you've got to realize that the murders occurred on the morning of January the 15th of 1978.
A date you'll never forget.
Really. And Bundy wasn't arrested until February the 15th of 1978. And so at that point in time, like I said before, nobody knew for sure whether Bundy was a suspect or not. And there had been a lot of investigation done in the meantime. I mean, whenever you have a series of murders that happen like this with a whodunit, nobody knows who possibly could have committed these horrendous crimes. The law enforcement was up in arms. I mean, they were stopping everybody on the street. Everybody was, locking their doors and closing their windows, the whole nine yards. So there was a lot of investigation that had been done before Bundy was ever arrested. And part of my responsibility, as I saw it, was to go back now and let's find out what, if anything, that prior investigation may have done to help point the finger either at Bundy or away from him, and at the same time follow up on all the leads on various types of evidence that may tie Bundy to the case. For example, one of the things that I did once the case was assigned to me is I traveled to Seattle, Washington, Salt Lake City, Utah, and also to Colorado to talk with the investigators in the various cases out in those areas to try to get as much information as I could from them to see whether or not any of the evidence that they may have had in their cases may have been of use to us.
Because at that point, he had already had cases going on, and he was either a suspect or he was a defendant in cases in those other states.
That's right. He had actually been convicted in Utah of aggravated kidnapping, and he was sentenced to an indeterminate term of between 1 year and 15 years in the Utah State Prison. While he was in the Utah State Prison, he was extradited to Colorado to stand charges of murder resulting from the death of a young nurse in Aspen, Colorado. And it was while he was awaiting trial in Colorado that he escaped not once but twice from the authorities out there.
It's crazy. It's so crazy. So how did the media attention and the sheriff reading the indictment in front of the media and all that stuff, how did it affect the trial and the location of the trial?
Well, It really impacted our ability to seat a fair and impartial jury here in Tallahassee. We attempted to do so, by the way. We spent 3 days trying to see if we could find an impartial jury here in Tallahassee, and after 3 days of...
What was that like? What were the potential jurors saying?
Almost all of them said that they could not be fair and impartial.
Meaning they just thought he did it?
Almost all of them knew the details of the crimes, the details of Mr. Bundy's history, had seen a video of the sheriff arresting Bundy in front of the cameras, and it was very obvious to everybody involved that the venue of the case had to be transferred to another location.
But before you even started picking that jury, didn't they try to move it, and the judge denied it, and then the judge had a... and the state, I guess, you all had to finally agree that you're right, we can't get a fair jury?
Well, actually, the way it works is the defense did file a motion for a change of venue prior to jury selection. But the judge took that motion under advisement and said that we would attempt to select a jury. And like I said, we spent about 3 days trying to do that, and it was very obvious to everybody that an impartial jury could not be found in Tallahassee. And at that point, the judge granted the motion for a change of venue and moved the venue to Miami, Florida.
Was there any worry in your mind that Miami was not a good venue for you? It's about the opposite as you can get in Florida, Tallahassee to Miami. Or did you feel pretty confident in your case the whole time?
Confident in my case the whole time, but of course that's a jurisdiction that I'm totally unfamiliar with, at least at that point in my career, and we would have much rather tried the case here in Tallahassee or somewhere in the North Florida area, but that decision was not left up to me. The judge made that decision, and here we went to Miami.
Now, the Tallahassee judge was recused from it, right?
Yes, the original judge in the case was Circuit Judge John Rudd, and Bundy moved to disqualify him, and ultimately the Florida Supreme Court.
What was the reasoning?
It did disqualify Judge Rudd. It was what I call kind of a typical disqualification motion, that the judge was prejudiced against him, that said things in court that were things that were unfavorable to him and stuff like that. It was pretty standard. If somebody wanted to get rid of a judge, it was that type of a motion. The problem was that Judge Rudd, I think he took it personally, and he wrote a very lengthy order denying the motion, which I'm sure, as you know, under Florida law, a judge who's confronted with a disqualification motion only has the option of finding that the motion is legally sufficient or legally insufficient.
Right.
The judge cannot comment on the allegations. Well, once the judge, Judge Rudd, commented on the allegations, it was a foregone conclusion. I felt that he would be removed from the case by the Florida Supreme Court.
Did you have any experience with Judge Cowart before going down to Miami and trying it in front of him?
The only experience I had with Judge Cowart was here in Tallahassee because he originally came to Tallahassee for the court proceedings prior to the venue being changed.
So all the pretrial proceedings were handled in Tallahassee before the actual trial was done in Miami?
Let's say most of the pretrial proceedings were done here in Tallahassee because once we got to Miami, the first thing we did was select the jury and have them sequestered. But after that, we then had additional pretrial hearings there in Miami before the trial actually started.
So for people that don't know, what does it mean to have a jury sequestered?
That means the jury was put up in a motel. They were not allowed to return home at night. They were fed and supervised 24 hours a day by members of the Sheriff's Department.
Were they limited in the media they could consume and people they could talk to, things like that?
Absolutely. They were not given access to newspaper reports about the case or television or anything else like that. where they may be able to get information concerning the case from some outside source, not within the courthouse.
Larry, this was one of the first trials that was televised. How did that come about? Did the media file a motion? Was it on the judge do it himself? How did that happen?
Well, at that point in time, there was a proceeding in place that basically permitted cameras in the courtroom, and there were orders that had been entered that indicated, you know, where a camera could be situated and things like that. There was, out of those orders, the media was permitted to have a camera that was running live, and they were allowed to have one still photographer. What the media had to do then was to pool and feed off of that one live camera, as well as the photographer that was allowed to be in the courtroom taking pictures.
Was this your first televised trial, the one first that you had done?
I think so, because this was like one of the first ones ever.
So how do you think it affected the court proceedings, the fact that it was televised, everybody in the courtroom, including yourself, knew it was televised and knew that? Did you realize how many people were watching it?
I had some idea, but I didn't. I really had no idea the magnitude of it.
So how do you think it affected the court proceedings, if at all? Do you think, you know, you prepared your opening and closing any differently, more, you know, poster boards and pictures and physical evidence, you had pictures of CSI style? Do you think the judge acted any different, the defense lawyers?
Frankly, I don't think anybody acted any differently. I know from my perspective, you know, I didn't have time to worry about what the media was doing. I was focused on one thing, and that was trying to get this case tried and Bundy convicted. And you know, the cameras were there, so what? They had been at every pretrial hearing that we'd ever been to, and, you know, we just had to proceed on. The only real criticism that I have ever had of cameras in the courtroom, a good example of this did happen in the Bundy case, and that was during one of the pretrial hearings. One of the witnesses, Nita Neary, who was at the Chi Omega sorority house the night of the murders and saw a man that she later identified as Bundy coming down the stairway from the upstairs where the girls' rooms were. She was on the witness stand for probably 7 hours that day, and she was a great witness. But at one point in time, she broke down and started to cry after, you know, about 4 hours of, you know, just horrendous cross-examination of her. And that night on the 6 o'clock news, of course, the only thing that you saw on the newscast was her breaking down and crying. I thought it was unfair to her and really unfair to the process, but that's neither here nor there. That's the way the media sometimes tries to use what they see and hear in a courtroom.
So what about Bundy himself? How much of the case did he actually handle himself pro se, defending himself? How much of it was actually handled by his lawyers? How much did he put on for the camera? What was he like throughout the proceedings?
Well, Bundy represented himself for several months. I can't tell you how many for sure, but I know there was a four-month period of time there where under Florida law, in a case like this, the defense has the right to take depositions from state witnesses. And I spent about 4 months going to the Leon County Jail every day, taking witnesses out there so that Bundy could take their depositions.
What was that like?
Well, Mr. Bundy was a perfect gentleman. I mean, he asked really good questions. He was, you know, polite. You know, direct to the point, ask questions that you would expect a lawyer to ask. There was never any issue that came up during any of those depositions. Of course, we did the depositions in the jail in a conference room, but of course we had correctional officers on standby in the room with us while he was doing the deposition, so I don't think anyone ever had any fear of Mr. Bundy under those circumstances. But nevertheless, I mean, some of the witnesses that came in to testify were Chi Omega sisters or others that were, you know, witnesses in the case who had seen Bundy on the night of the murders and things like that. And obviously, they were very concerned. But fortunately, everybody got through it okay. We didn't have any problems doing that.
What about in the trial itself? What did Bundy actually do in the trial, if anything?
Well, during the trial, he was represented by lawyers. And I think it was either the second or third witness that I called to testify for the state. His name was Officer Ray Crew. He was with the FSU Police Department. And I called him because he was the one of the first officers on the scene, and he is the one that discovered the bodies of the two Chi Omega sisters who had been killed. And on direct examination, I had him on the witness stand for maybe 15 minutes at the most. I just wanted him to set the scene and say he found the body, because I had crime scene investigators who had photographs and all kinds of other stuff that they were going to put into evidence. I still had them coming to testify. And for some reason, out of a clear blue sky, Mr. Bundy decided that he wanted to cross-examine Officer Crew. And he got up there, and he asked Officer Crew to describe the scene in those girls' rooms with as much detail as you can recall. Now, I can't imagine anybody asking that question. I can't imagine a defense attorney asking that question. It's probably the worst question that's ever been asked in the history of the United States of a witness in a criminal case. The last thing in the world you want to do is to ask a witness like this, a law enforcement officer, to describe what they saw in as much detail as possible. I think the jury was really taken aback by that. I was just in awe. I couldn't believe that he had asked that question. And so Officer Crew began answering the question, at which point one of the lawyers got up and went over to Mr. Bundy. I called him over to one side, and Mr. Bundy said thank you and sat down and quit asking questions.
How many lawyers did Bundy go through during the course of the case?
Gosh, it was probably somewhere in excess of 7 or 8. There were a lot of lawyers that were involved in the case from time to time. And by my count, there were 7 that were in the courtroom in Miami at one point in time.
Did he?
Of course, Bundy was not shy about firing lawyers either. And during the middle of the trial, one of the lawyers apparently made Bundy mad or something, I don't know, and he told him to get lost, and the lawyer withdrew from the case right during the middle of the trial.
Yeah, that's in the documentary, one of the documentaries that I saw.
How long did the trial last?
Well, let's see, I was in Miami for a little over 6 weeks, and I would say the guilt phase probably lasted somewhere a little over 4 weeks, and the penalty phase, I think, was 3 days.
Okay, so a lot of your evidence was scientific evidence. And one of the ones that I found interesting were the teeth marks or the bite marks. Now, as time has gone on, that kind of evidence has been called into question. Do you think that there was an overemphasis by your expert of the bite marks, or do you think that he was accurate when he said it was definitely Bundy?
Well, let me start by saying that I think a lot of the criticism that bite mark evidence has received more recently is totally justified. I think there were, at one point in time, there were a lot of experts that claimed expertise that really weren't experts and didn't really know what they were doing. But I think the difference here in our particular case is we had a very unique bite mark, and Bundy had a very unique set of teeth. What was unique about the bite mark is that it was not just a bite mark. It was a double bite mark. In other words, this was a situation where Bundy bit the victim once, released, and went back and bit a second time, almost in the exact same location. He just turned his head slightly in making that second bite. So that what we had here was not one bite mark to make a comparison with, but we had two. So that the bite marks themselves could be compared against each other, and each of those bite marks could be compared against Bundy's teeth. And but as I said, this Mr. Bundy had a very unique set of teeth. His lower jaw was the set of teeth that was actually used for the comparison here. And his teeth were, to start with, the width of the arch of his teeth was very narrow for an adult human. The teeth themselves, some of the teeth were twisted. Some were higher in the arch, some were lower in the arch. The canine teeth had very unique individual characteristics to them, all of which you could see in the bite mark itself. And as I mentioned earlier, we were able to take the bite mark photograph that we had and make it a one-to-one. And what you could actually do is to take the model of Mr. Bundy's teeth and just put it right down on the bite marks that were shown on that photograph and see it for yourself. Now, having said all of that, I never believed that the bite mark evidence alone was sufficient to get a conviction in this case. To the contrary, this was a circumstantial evidence case in my mind, that we always had to put together the other circumstances of the case in order to prove that Bundy is the one that did it. For example, we were able to find witnesses who were in a nightclub that was right next door to the Kyle Mega House, who identified Bundy as being in that nightclub just hours before the murders occurred. So that we were able to put Bundy in the vicinity, I mean, like right next door to the crime scene, just a couple of hours before the murders happened. We were also able to find two young men who were who lived in the same boarding house with Mr. Bundy, who happened to be up at somewhere around 4:30 to 4:45 a.m. that morning when they saw Bundy come home. So they were they already knew Mr. Bundy, although they knew him under a different name, and saw him coming in. So we had him on the streets, next door to the Kyle Mega House before the crimes were committed, and then we had him just an hour or so later coming back to his residence. I've always felt that that type of circumstantial evidence is very, very strong in a case like this.
In reading the comments of the judge, one of the things I found interesting was it seemed like he had some respect for Bundy. It just seemed like he either respected his intelligence or respected his abilities, but there seemed to be something there between the judge and Bundy. Is that the way it came out during the trial?
Well, I think the judge did respect him, and frankly, so did I. You know, one of the things that I felt like I had to do in this case was I had to treat this case very professionally. It could have easily degenerated, and I could have tried to do everything in my power to prejudice the jury against him, to do stuff like that, but that never happened. And I think that was kind of the judge's attitude as well, is that we had to approach this from a very professional attitude and show total and complete respect for Mr. Bundy.
And I think some of that probably stemmed from what had already happened in the case and the procedural history with the previous judge and the sheriff's office reading the indictment aloud and things like that, that, you know, you guys probably see this is not the type of case you needed to do that on. You just present your case the proper way and justice will prevail, hopefully.
I think that's exactly right. That's the way I felt about it.
So when you were actually in the trial, most everything I see and hear and read about it says that the gallery was kind of crazy compared to a normal trial. It was full. It was loud at times. What was that like?
I really don't have any thoughts about the gallery. Yeah, there were a lot of people there, and it was packed full, but I don't have any recollection of there being any outbursts or anything else like that that was improper that happened in the gallery itself.
Larry, I read that there were groupies there for Bundy. Did you see any groupies?
I did not. There may have been. But again, as I said earlier, I was more focused on what I had to do than I was worried about the media or the people that were sitting there watching the trial.
Was there ever, I guess before we get to that, I'll ask you this question because a bunch of people asked us to ask you, even though I know it wasn't during this trial. Was it true that Ted actually proposed while his girlfriend was on the stand during trial?
That's my understanding. I was not present for that. That was during the Kimberly Leach case. But I understand he did. Whether or not they ever signed a marriage license, I don't know.
And so when you were going throughout this trial and you felt confident in your case the entire time, was there ever a time that a plea deal was offered or considered by Bundy to where it would be something less than the death penalty?
Yes. There came a point in time where we did get into discussions with Mr. Bundy's attorney, Mike Minerva, who was the public defender here in Tallahassee. And what we ultimately came, what it ultimately came down to is that Bundy, according to his lawyer, would agree to plead guilty to all of the charges, which would include the two homicide cases in Tallahassee, as well as the Kimberly Leach case. And he would be sentenced to life without parole for 75 years on those three homicides. When we went before the court to have Bundy enter that plea, once we got everybody into the courtroom, the first thing that happened is Bundy stood up and started making a speech and criticizing his lawyers. And at that point in time, me and the prosecutor in the Kimberly Leach case looked at each other and stood up and said, "This is over with.
No more deals."
No, we will not go through with a deal under circumstances like this.
So did anything come out during your trial about his relationship with this girl that he met while he was, you know, in prison and they get married and I think they even had a kid, or did you experience any of that throughout your trial?
No, none of that happened in my trial.
So after the conviction came down and Bundy was actually convicted of the homicides in Tallahassee, what was the post-conviction timeline like? How heavily involved were you? Did anything get close to giving him a new trial or anything like that?
I was not directly involved in the post-conviction case. I was consulted by the Attorney General's office. They were the ones that were assigned to handle the post-conviction motions. And I went through several different things with them. They asked me to. I reviewed transcripts for them and stuff like that, but I was not directly involved. I really don't think any of those post-conviction motions really got off the ground very far.
So in the trial and in the post-conviction world of the Ted Bundy case, what were his best arguments, in your opinion? What were his best arguments during trial, either that he wasn't there, that it was somebody else, or whatever his defense was? And was there anything in the trial that, you know, you thought held any water in the post-conviction world?
Well, his defense, of course, was that he didn't do it. And, yes, there were some issues that were involved, one of which was the fact that the Sheriff's Department had Nita Neary, who I mentioned earlier. They had her hypnotized, and this became a big issue on the direct appeal because
they actually hypnotized her.
Yes, she had been hypnotized, and she later identified Bundy in court as the person that she saw. And there was a big issue on appeal about this post-hypnotic identification that was being made. Fortunately, the Florida Supreme Court affirmed on that issue as well, although they were, it was obvious that it was a troubling issue for them as well.
So what about during the trial? Anything else besides, you know, it wasn't me? Did he, how much of the collateral damage, we'll call, came out? How much of his previous cases or the stolen material he was picked up with in Pensacola that was all from Tallahassee, the false names he was using in Tallahassee, how much did that come into the actual murder trial?
That did not come in.
Okay.
Not during the guilt phase. We attempted to get some of that evidence in. And in particular, here in Tallahassee, we had not one crime scene, but two. The Kyle Mega house is the one that everybody usually references. But there was a second crime scene here that we referred to as the Dunwoody residence. The Dunwoody residence was a duplex. And one of the other victims in this case was Cheryl Thomas, who lived in one side of that duplex. And within about 45 minutes of the Kyle Mega murders happening and being called into law enforcement, the next-door neighbors of Cheryl Thomas started hearing this loud noises coming from next door, beating and banging, and they tried to call Cheryl. They tried to, you know, get her to respond in some way, and she wouldn't. And they ended up calling law enforcement themselves. And when they arrived, they found Cheryl Thomas in a pool of blood on her bed. It would later be determined that she had her skull had been fractured five different places. She was really in bad shape. But one of the things that was found in the Cheryl Thomas residence was a pantyhose mask, a mask that was made out of a pair of women's pantyhose with eye holes cut in them. Well, I mentioned earlier that you know, I had been out west to talk with those investigators, and one of the things that I found out there was that when Bundy was arrested in Utah, he had a bag with him that the original officers thought was a bag full of burglary tools. It included things like handcuffs, an ice pick, a hammer, and a pair of pantyhose that was made into a mask. And so one of the things that I tried to introduce during our trial was the pantyhose mask from Utah to show, you know, similarity, you know, modus operandi, you know, that kind of stuff. And the judge would not permit us to introduce it into evidence.
Larry, one of the things you've mentioned, you've talked about a penalty phase and guilt phase. I think people need to know that in Florida there's actually two parts of a murder trial: the part that finds a person guilty and not guilty, and then the part that whether or not they're going to be sentenced to death. And those are actually two separate phases and two separate trials that actually occur.
That's correct.
When you talk about the penalty phase, in this case, you say it took 4 weeks.
No, 3 days for the penalty phase.
No, I'm talking about the death, the guilt phase. Guilt phase took 4 weeks. You and I have both tried a lot of murder cases. What's the typical length of a murder case?
Well, you know, George, like I do, they vary. You know, some of them, you know, I've tried murder cases in 3 days before. And a typical murder case around here back in those days probably be a week. But it's not anything unusual to try one for 4 months or 6 months or even longer.
Depending on the complexity of the case.
It really does.
Right. So throughout this case, when you were dealing with the victims, how did that affect how you handled the case? How did it affect kind of the way you went about it, like you said, professionally and things like that? And how did it affect the way you handled the media?
Well, let me talk about handling the media. I just, you know, took the position that I wasn't going to comment on the case to the media and let them, you know, whatever I said in court was fair game. They could, you know, report on it all they wanted to. But the only thing that I would ever give in terms of a statement to the media prior to the verdicts in the case were just simply things like, you know, date and time of hearings and what motions would be heard and, you know, stuff like that, just procedural stuff. I I would never say anything that could be misinterpreted or used to try to show some sort of prejudice against Mr. Bundy.
Well, those things you just mentioned are also all public record.
Yes, surely.
And then what about dealing with the victims?
Well, I spent a lot of time with the victims. I cared about them. I met the families of the victims that were murdered. So I felt a lot toward those people. I know how they feel. I'm still in touch with some of the victims that lived. I saw Cheryl Thomas not too long ago, as a matter of fact. I saw one of the women that lived next door to Cheryl and called the sheriff's department the other that night. I saw her just a month or so ago. She was having lunch at the same restaurant that I was in. So I see these people all the time. I still have a great deal of a feeling for all of them.
Larry, any good prosecutor has a strong feeling for the victims, especially in a homicide case, a case as brutal as this. And I'm sure you did too. So I'm going to ask you a broad question now, that this particular case, and obviously it's one that people still talk about, you still hear about. How does this case, how did it affect you, your family, and your career?
Well, to start with, I was working on this case for 14 months, give or take. And this is the only case I had. And it was a 24-hour a day, 7 days a week job. I never rested. I felt like, time was of the essence. We needed to get this case put together. And once we had it together, we needed to get it to trial. And, George, I'm sure you can appreciate this. I mean, we were able to get this case to trial in a year, from indictment to trial.
Which is actually quick. People don't realize, but that's quick.
Yes, it's very, very quick in a first-degree murder case. I spent a lot of time on the road. I spent a lot of time talking to witnesses, a lot of time, lining up expert witnesses and so forth. We didn't really go into detail about the forensic odontologist, but I actually hired four forensic odontologists in this case. The reason why is because bite mark evidence had never been admitted in a court of law in the state of Florida before this case. There's absolutely no precedent for it. And back in those days, Florida was a Fry state. And what that means is that under United States versus Fry, in order to admit novel or new scientific evidence into a court of law, you had to show that it was the type of procedure that was generally accepted in the scientific community. And so what I did in order to beat that burden is I hired a forensic odontologist from Miami. That was Dr. Suvron that we talked about earlier. I hired Dr. Loyal Levine from New York City, their medical examiner's office. I hired Dr. Homer Campbell from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I hired Dr. Norm Sperber from San Diego, California.
So you built your own scientific community.
Yes, across the United States is exactly what I wanted to do. And we actually had a hearing, a pretrial hearing, that lasted 3 days in Tallahassee on the admissibility of bite mark evidence, and I called all four of those forensic odontologists to testify about the procedures that were used and why, in this particular case, the comparison being made with Bundy's teeth was consistent with generally accepted scientific principle.
So what about, again, how did it affect your life, your family, or your career?
Well, I mean, it... it was a tremendous impact. Like I said before, I was spending 24 hours a day working on this case. I was married at the time. My wife, she spent a lot of lonely nights, I'm sure, with me out of town and otherwise working. But we were able to get through it. The fact that I handled the case, it did a lot in terms of my career, in the sense that, everybody knows about the Bundy case. And so it's an excellent way to be introduced to someone, a new client or, a friend or any other type of introduction that can be made. Immediately everybody recognizes the case and knows all about it and wants to know about it. And so it's a great thing to have in my resume to have going forward. The other thing that it did is, as a result of this case, I really got into forensic evidence, and I became a member of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. I have done presentations at their annual meetings before on things related to other aspects of forensic evidence. I've been asked to, get involved in many cases, simply because of my expertise in forensic sciences. I was telling somebody yesterday about this, but I'm actually handling a case right now that's in federal court down in Tampa, where forensic evidence is the whole key to the case. Even though it's a civil case, it involves scientific evidence of causation relating to whether or not vegetable seeds could have caused damage to a farmer's crop and things like that. I mean, it's allowed me to develop an expertise in scientific evidence that over the years I've used extensively.
So overall, what is your feeling about all of the documentaries and Netflix movies and reenactments that have been done as someone that was intimately involved in such a heinous crime? What is kind of your feeling about, some people feel like it's glorifying them or it's giving Ted Bundy fame or it's, harmful to the victims. What is your feeling about, all the things that have come out about Ted Bundy since the time you tried the case?
Well, my feeling is that it's a story that needs to be told. People don't realize, even here in Tallahassee today, that, you're never safe. And you need to lock your doors. You need to be vigilant. You need to be concerned about your safety. And if nothing else, I think these documentaries really emphasize that because, I mean, Bundy's MO was such that, he not only picked up young girls on the street or at parks or at schoolyards or whatever, but he actually entered houses and homes and apartments and killed inside. I just think it's a story that needs to be told.
And it also shows, doesn't matter really what somebody looks like or sounds like or how smart or charming they are, you never really know a stranger.
That's exactly right. I mean, the thing about Bundy is he can fit in anywhere. He could be on this phone call or he could be sitting in a room with us right now. And he would carry
sitting next to us in law school.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he would talk like a lawyer. He would sound like a lawyer. He would have appropriate mannerisms. He would be dressed appropriately. You would never know in a million years that he was a serial killer.
Larry, I'm trying to remember, the Kyle house, was the door unlocked?
Well, that's a good question. Nobody knows. What we've always believed is that Bundy entered Kyle Mega house through a back door that was that had a keypad that the girls could use to gain entry after hours. We know that before the murders, that door was malfunctioning, not actually closing like it should all the time. But we also know Mr. Bundy, and there are several instances out west where Bundy gained entrance to people's homes or apartments, absolutely no sign of forced entry, no indication of how he may have gotten into those locations. For that matter, we don't know how he got into Dunwoody. There's no sign of forced entry there.
So somebody could have just opened the door and invited him in.
I would not expect Cheryl Thomas to have done that.
Well, this was awesome. I really appreciate you taking the time to come talk to us, Larry. It was fun. We learned so much, and this is such a fascinating story. And I agree. I think they do need to be told, and I think that they actually a lot of good can come from telling these stories and remembering even something as heinous as this.
I couldn't agree more.
Larry, thank you very much for taking the time.
Certainly.
You've been listening to Peter's Proffer with Clearwater attorney Peter Trakos. The experienced lawyers at Trakos, Sartes & Trakos discuss common legal questions, providing insight into the legal process and covering current events as they relate to the legal field. Find out more at TrakosLaw.com.